You're listening to HP3R, Higher Power Ranger Recovery Radio. All recovery, all the time. And once again, it's time for your daily dose of recovery, brought to you by David. Welcome, everybody, to the show. A few weeks ago, I received an email from a listener asking questions and for advice. I found myself writing so much when answering back that I thought, why not just turn my answers into an episode here on Daily Dose of Recovery? Now, I certainly don't think of myself as some kind of know-it-all, and for the record, any advice that is given should be thoroughly evaluated before making up your own mind when it comes to any decision. That said, I'm always willing to share what wisdom I have derived from my experiences during my recovery journey. So when it comes to questions about program and recovery, I'm happy to talk things over. Getting to answer someone's questions through outreach is an excellent example of how the connections that we make in program can serve to strengthen our own recovery. So thank you to this person and everyone else who writes me, and I hope you enjoy my thoughts in this episode. But rest assured, anonymity will be maintained at all times. Now, on with the show. Throughout the message, the author asked multiple questions, starting on a general basis and then progressing towards asking for my advice about an ex-partner of hers. Again, no personal information will be shared in this podcast, so I'll only be addressing the questions that were specifically related to me and not her or anyone else in her life. The first question was, do you think you've become a different person in recovery than you were before? I think I have become more myself, more of who I was before my eating reached the levels of obsessive compulsive behavior, levels where I found myself eating meals amounting to more than 10,000 calories to feel pleasure and also make myself drowsy enough to fall asleep. When you weigh in the 600 and 700 pound range, it becomes very difficult to get to sleep at night. The bulk of my body literally made it difficult to get comfortable and fall asleep. So I would eat to help knock myself out, which in turn only made me gain more weight, thus making things worse in multiple ways that even now, as I think back on those years, my actions feel so insane. But that is the kind of powerlessness that comes with obsessive compulsive eating, and why, when it comes to addictive behaviors, it is so difficult to stop. I knew how dumb it was to eat that food in those amounts, even as I was doing it, and no amount of logic or willpower on my part could bring those self-destructive cycles to an end, not on my own. But now I am abstaining from that kind of behavior, and I am past the halfway point to my healthy goal weight. There's one more example I'd like to share that I think shows how different I am now compared to what I was like when I first came into program. I've mentioned before that I do mirror work every morning to start my day with a positive, affirming attitude. One of the affirmations that I do every Tuesday is to look in the mirror and tell myself that I love my fill in the blank, and it's supposed to be a reference to some aspect of my physical appearance. I usually say things like, I love my face, or I love how strong my legs are, or I love my hair even though it's almost entirely gray. It's a nice way to enact kindness towards myself and promote my self-esteem. Yet, when I first started doing mirror work, I couldn't think of anything to say when it came to that affirmation on my list. That's where I was. That's how I saw myself, and the fact that I couldn't think of anything nice to say about how I looked back then is something that I'm still not fully comfortable with. I mean, what does that say about me and the way my thoughts worked back then? I can't fully answer that, But when I reflect back on what my daily attitude, mood, and thoughts were while I was in the 700s and 600s, I have to be honest with myself and accept that back then, I was my own worst antagonist. The fact that it was so difficult for me at first to have something kind and affirming to say about my physical appearance is testimony to that. I struggled to say something nice to myself, about myself, while I was alone in my bathroom, looking myself in the eye, in the mirror. That's the kind of dark place I was in back then at the start of program. Maybe you are too, dear listener, but you don't have to stay there. Today, and for many months now, my thoughts are mostly positive, and affirmations that I say to myself are things that I believe when it comes to who I am, and this is one of the ways I have experienced the complete psychic change that the Big Book of AA says is required to end addictive behaviors. Just as I don't need a 10,000 calorie meal to make me sleepy, I don't need any fatty, sugary junk food to make me feel better about who I am and the life that I am leading. I feel good about myself now. I am confident and investing in my own well-being and happiness in as many different ways as I can because I deserve to be happy. Just like the author of this email, she deserves to be happy, as does anyone else who is willing to face themselves in the mirror, be honest about how you feel in that moment, and then work towards a better, kinder way of treating yourself. Again, describing myself as being a different person now is not accurate enough. I have removed negative aspects in my life while also working to develop new elements. Yes, I've been losing weight, which improves my overall health, functionality, and confidence, but I've done so much more than just reduce the number that shows up on the scale when I weigh in on the first of each month. Mostly, I feel more and more like myself. And I'm working towards what I want to be. So, yes, there is a difference, but it is more like clearing away debris so that a garden can flourish and grow. Which is why I often use garden metaphors in my journal writing. The next question in the email was, are there parts of your life that you no longer tolerate because of your recovery? Yes. Most certainly there are. I have learned to value myself in ways that I never really felt. So I no longer tolerate being mistreated, undervalued, nor do I engage in people-pleasing, not like I used to, not in ways that drove me to keep going to the food for comfort that eventually resulted in my addictive eating habits spinning further and further out of control. Her email continues with this question. Did you make changes elsewhere in your life once you became abstinent because you were more present and you realized that those circumstances were no longer tolerable? Again, yes, most certainly. I ended certain relationships, established healthy boundaries that were badly needed elsewhere, and I worked hard to refine my own attitudes and actions towards other people. I've become less angry and more accepting of the realities of why people behave the way that they do. I got rid of a lot of whining thoughts and feelings, and I stopped indulging the polite lies that people would tell me. I am interested in truth and what needs to be done to reach my goals. I want to live a life that advances towards and achieves those goals rather than remaining stagnant and waiting for things to be given to me as if I were entitled to them for some reason. The metaphorical fuel that drives me towards my goals comes from my higher power sustaining me and also from the many tools that I use each day in my action plan to actively oppose the old self-destructive habits that were the staple of my day-to-day living back then. As a side note, I really liked in the email how immediately after asking that last question, the author shared this. I only have 170 days of abstinence. I think she says that because she's not sure she should be asking these questions because she considers herself to still be new to OA. First off, anyone can ask a question about program and recovery. That's how we learn and grow. And second, 170 days is amazing. Keep it going. You're doing great. At the time of this episode's recording, I have 612 days of continuous abstinence. And you know how I got to 612 days? The same way that she got to 170 days, by taking it one day at a time. Now, at the end of the message, she asks one final question. Did you find that you changed in recovery and that you wouldn't go back to certain situations that you put yourself in before? I think it's fair to say that the central issue of all of her questions is, do I think that people can change? My answer to that is, absolutely. But change must come from the individual person. It cannot come from someone else, like a friend, a family member, or loved one. And it must be a change that the individual is willing and able to do. For example, if a person has a medical condition that they're not willing to work on, then there's nothing that anyone can do to make that person want to work on their situation. In such cases, I think it is best to accept that person as they are, or accept that they don't want to change. And that's not a negative reflection on them or anyone else. I think it's very dangerous to expect other people to change for us for an external reason rather than for an internal, personal reason. But I also have to acknowledge that there are tons of romantic comedy movies and books out there that feature characters who grow and change in order to win the love of their significant other, which is a nice plot device, but not something that can really function in the reality of life, because then the issue becomes, who is going to change for who? And that's a very dangerous, slippery slope of self-esteem issues, as well as an act of keeping score to bring into a relationship. I think keeping score turns a relationship from about being together and enriching each other's lives into keeping an extensive inventory of who did what, which sounds exhausting to me. In life, we meet people who check a lot of the important boxes regarding what we are looking for in a romantic partner or in a platonic friendship. But if they don't also check other equally important boxes, then there is, at least in my opinion, a priority system that comes to what we want in life, whether that's regarding a search for a significant other or seeking out meaningful friendships and camaraderie. In other words, you need to have a clear understanding of what you are looking for in the people that you invite into your life, as well as a healthy amount of accepting people for who they are, as they are, and not as you would hope to make them. And no one should ever expect being in a relationship to be a kind of solution to their life. Each individual needs to be a whole person on their own, one that is invested in their own happiness, well-being, and goals. Seriously, one of the most destructive romantic lines in a movie was, "You complete me." No. No! None of us need anyone else to complete us. That's not a healthy way to look at life or to live it. So let me stress this. I think that everyone should prioritize their self and their family members when it comes to who we choose to include in our lives. And it is a choice when you decide to develop a friendship or a romantic relationship with someone. In either a friendship or a romantic coupling, it is very dangerous to put another person in a higher position of priority over your own well-being and happiness. Let me say that again, perhaps more plainly. In my opinion, you should never place another person's well-being above your own safety and happiness or the safety and happiness of your family members. For those of you who are single parents, you do not have the luxury. No, wait, that's not the right word. Luxury is not a word that should be used to describe romantic relationships because the relationship itself is built upon dedicated work and effort by both individuals involved. Rather, let me say, single parents have the responsibility to choose a person to share their life with who matches the most important prioritized needs regarding their personal well-being and the well-being of their children, because whoever a single parent chooses to date, that person will have an impact on the lives of their kids while their children are growing up, and after their kids are grown and have started families of their own. Now, while everything I said above is absolutely my honest opinion and should at some point factor into deciding whether or not to commit to a relationship, such as through marriage, it's not exactly something you should be worrying about on the first few dates when you're just getting to know each other. And if you are in a relationship with someone who makes you feel afraid or anxious or constantly nervous about how they will react to what you are doing, then that is a very unhealthy relationship that needs to change or end. Trust me, been there. So please permit me to reiterate this once again. Everyone deserves to be with someone who loves them, makes them feel good, and enriches the life that they share together. Obviously, everyone has faults, but we get to pick. Everyone gets to pick who they marry, who they fall in love with. And it is a choice. You have every right to choose to not to be with someone because they make you feel nervous or sad or they bring negativity into your life. This may not be the best answer because what I'm saying is that it's okay to disqualify certain people as potential romantic partners because of their faults, even when those faults are ones that are beyond their ability to control. But again, any relationship outside of a family relation is a choice. Marriage is a choice. Relationships are choices. And there is absolutely nothing to be ashamed of with making a choice that puts your well-being and the well-being of your kids first. My point is that if you end up with someone, then they should be somebody who brings a lot of joy and happiness, and there is nothing wrong with saying, this is the love I want, this is the love that I need, and then going out and looking for that love. I don't think anyone should ever settle. I have seen again and again and again people settle because they don't think that they can do any better and they feel a need to settle down and they end up in marriages that I think make them more miserable than happy. Not that we always get everything that we want, but you should get what is important to you and you shouldn't have to put up with things that make you feel really awful. Which brings me back to my original answer to the central theme of all these questions. If someone is willing to work on their character defects, then yes, people can change. Anyone can change and become better. And not just a physical change, but also emotional and spiritual. In fact, without the spiritual hope and strength, such as that found in a 12-step program like OA, then I never would have changed my emotional process and thus produced significant physical change through weight loss over the past 2 years. To sum things up, everyone deserves to be loved. Anyone can change if they are willing to work on themselves and are willing to seek out their goals. The seeking is important, the active working towards what we want in life. I, for one, am willing to work on myself and seek out my goals, my change, and that's why I have faith that things will work out. I would encourage everyone to not settle and compromise who you are and what your values are. No one is going to change another person. It cannot be done. Change must come from the individual. It cannot come from an external source. You can see the truth of that in the 12-step programs. The first 6 steps are all about you. It is not until step 7 that your higher power acts, because that's the step where you humbly ask your higher power to remove your character defects. Look at the language of the 7-step prayer. God, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. One more thing before I wrap this up. There is no fault in having character defects or medical conditions that limit us. Everyone needs to accept who we are as individuals, and the first person who needs to make that act of acceptance is each of us towards ourselves. Once we accept who we are, then we can truthfully decide what we can and cannot do to make ourselves better. And I say that as much to each of you as I do to myself. The ultimate responsibility to walk a different path that leads to a better way of living life resides with each of us. That's what recovery is, a means by which to live a healthier life by being responsible for our decisions, regardless of whoever influenced us in the past. In the present, here and now, it is my responsibility and only my responsibility to live each day as best I can, completing the actions that I know will result in my life changing for the better. And I have the willingness to follow through on each of those actions, which is why I have changed and will continue to change as I progress in my recovery. Because, like the Alicorn recently pointed out to me, I'm taking small steps every day to become who I want to be, and I do that every day, one day at a time. Hey everyone, thanks for listening, and I hope you all enjoyed this episode. If any of you ever want to write and ask me questions or suggest topics for episodes, please feel free to send an email. I'm always thrilled to hear from listeners and grateful to each of you for sharing fellowship with me. You've been listening to HP3R, Higher Power Ranger Recovery Radio. All recovery, all the time. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing to the podcast and leaving a review. If you'd like to send us an email, then write to hp3rpodcast@gmail.com. Remember to tune in on Mondays for episodes of Recovery Buddies with David, and check back on Thursdays for future episodes of Daily Dose of Recovery, here on HP3R.